Hey, this is Jack Cordero, and you're listening to the Nats GM Show.
Welcome, everyone, to the latest edition of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available via the Nats GM Radio Network. I am your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the baron of all baseball podcasts. This week's guest is Baseball Hall of Fame voter Larry Rocca. Larry worked for the Orange County Register as a beat writer for the Angels and Dodgers in the mid-90s and covered the Mets and the Yankees beat for the Star-Ledger through the early 2000s. After this work, he spent nearly 5 years serving as the Deputy Managing Director of Business Operations for the Chiba Loit Baseball Club, hope I said that correctly, in the Japanese League. A fellow Georgetown Prep alumnus and a personal friend of mine, I am excited to talk some baseball with him today. Larry, welcome to the Nats GM Show.
Ryan, thank you for having me, and it's great to talk to you.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I got to know you at your years at Prep, and always had fun talking baseball with you, and you were always so encouraging of my work and my site and everything else. So it's a real treat to talk to you today with the Hall of Fame voting, I guess, tomorrow. So
yeah, the announcement will be at 2 p.m. tomorrow on MLB Network. Yeah, on Tuesday. I don't know when this will air, or this podcast will air, but Tuesday at 2 p.m. is when the announcement will be made. The ballots were due, had to be postmarked by December 27th.
Gotcha. So for those in the audience who may not know you too well, can you describe your impressive career in baseball?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Sure. Can you just walk everybody, the audience, through your early career, your career in baseball?
Yeah, so I worked for a sports TV production company. My first job out of college, I worked for 1 year in sports TV production. And my real love was baseball, and so one of my college roommates and I were working for that TV network. We ended up getting jobs in minor league baseball, and I split the so 1990 I worked for the TV network. It was called NISLU Sports News Network. Went out of business. It's no longer on the air. And in 91, I split the year between the San Antonio Missions, which at the time were double A affiliate for the Dodgers, and the Eugene Emeralds, which were the short season A-ball team for the Kansas City Royals at that time in Eugene, Oregon. And after those 2 years of being around sports and sports media and baseball, I thought I really, I love this. I love being around sports, but I'm afraid if I go much further in baseball or in TV, it'll be very difficult to get into sports writing, baseball writing, which is something that I was also very interested in. And figured if I devoted myself to writing and developed that skill, I could always make the jump back to either one of those other fields, TV or sports management. So I went to my college homecoming, Colby College in Maine, and through one of my friends there who I'd worked with on the school newspaper, got me a connection to another Colby alumnus who was the sports editor of a small paper in Massachusetts, and that guy gave me some part-time work, and then, you know, I wrote stories there, and then I ended up getting my foot in the door at the Washington Post through another one of our mutual friends, William Gilday, the great, 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 longtime feature writer for the Washington Post, and published author of several books, was a great mentor of mine. His two sons, I was baseball teammates with them, actually, in grade school and at Prep, at Little Flower and at Prep. I played with Billy and David Gilday almost every year from about third grade through junior year of high school. I was teammates with one or the other. And year and a half at the Washington Post, covering high schools and colleges and local professional sports, then I got a break, and with the help of Tony Kornheiser and Michael Wilbon and William Gilday and Ken Denlinger, Len Shapiro, George Solomon was the sports editor. There was a lot of Gene McManus, assistant sports editor. So many people were really supportive and encouraging me. And Norman Chad and Emilio Garcia Ruiz. Now Emilio is the managing editor at the Post. He was in Orange County, and Norman Chad was in L.A. And they got me in at the Register, and I covered the Angels in 1994, which was incredible. Like, suddenly I'm going from covering high schools and for the Washington Post as a part-timer to covering the Angels for the main newspaper in Orange County. And and it was incredibly exciting, but also very overwhelming. I had no idea what I was doing, and you know, it was a real struggle just to get the stories in on time and all that. But
sure.
And then, of course, that year was canceled by the strike, which was a huge disappointment. The season, you know, was shortened in August, and the World Series was canceled. And so that year also, though, turned out to be this massive explosion in offensive performance. And I remember Buck Rogers saying in spring training that he thought the ball was juiced, and I had no way to compare it. And there were whispers and talks of guys using steroids, which had started up mostly around Jose Canseco in the late 80s. People started talking about his milkshakes and other things like that. But I didn't really know, you know, what to make of it, and I had nothing to compare it to, and I was still really very wide-eyed and just so in love with baseball and so excited to be around. And then I got switched to cover the Dodgers in 95 and 96 for the Register, and Hideo Nomo showed up in 1995. He was the first player from Japan to jump from their league to our league. He's not the first Japanese native to play in the major leagues. Masanori Murakami had done that 30 years prior for the Giants, but he was the first guy who had been established in their professional league to make the jump over here. And that was, you know, big change for baseball. Also opened the door to many, many guys, and which is, by the way, which is why I voted for him last year. I thought, although he's not equal to Jackie Robinson, I thought he was comparable to Robinson in that he opened the door for an ethnic group and a group of guys that had been basically excluded, you know, through a gentleman's agreement of owners in, previously. So covered the Angels, covered the Dodgers in 95, 96, Tommy Lasorda's last years, Nomo's first years, Mike Piazza going crazy, hitting home runs everywhere. Very exciting. And then I missed the East Coast. I missed the change of seasons and the pace of life. And I got a job covering the Mets for the Star Ledger in 97. And Bobby Valentine was their manager, and he was close with Lasorda, and Lasorda liked me, and Bobby and I hit it off, and then the Mets and Yankees were both trying to get Irabu, and I had a lot of interest in Japanese baseball from Nomo, so, and Bobby had managed Irabu in Japan in 95. He'd been there for a year, so we had that in common. And then my prep, our fellow prep alumnus, my prep classmate, teammate, Brian Cashman, was assistant GM of the Yankees. He got promoted to GM the following year. So it was really, and then that following year in July of 98, Newsday hired me to cover the Yankees. And so suddenly I was at the sixth biggest paper in the country covering the Yankees, who were on route to winning 125 games, including the postseason. My high school teammate is the GM of the team. You know, I've got a good relationship with Bobby V. Piazza had been acquired by the Mets. Baseball in New York was really on the rise. I mean, the Yankees had won in 96, but the Mets hadn't been good in a while. And
right.
Bobby restored them, and they rose back to prominence. So I covered the Yankees through 2000 and then played the Subway Series, Yankees and Mets. Went back to the Ledger in 01 to cover the Mets, and then was promoted to baseball columnist in 02. So I did that for 02, 03, and 04. I was a columnist for the Star Ledger. It's a long history. Sorry, hopefully your podcast can accommodate this. And then my life kind of turned upside down. My dad died. I was engaged to be married. We broke that off, quit my newspaper job, and I went to work for Bobby in Japan for 5 years for the Chiba Lotte Marines baseball team in Japan. And we won the championship my first year there. It had nothing to do with me, of course. I was working in the business operations, doing promotions and marketing and corporate sales. But it was still incredibly exciting. The team had not won in 31 years, and we won the championship that first year. And it was a huge deal, you know, massive victory parade, and Bobby was a real superstar over there. So it was just really a magic carpet ride for 5 years there.
Yeah, I mean, you've had a surreal, just going through all those players and topics and scenes that you've seen. I could talk for an hour just on that, but but I think,
you know, I've been very lucky. Very exciting. I've seen a lot of really cool stuff, and along the way, I earned the Hall of Fame vote because the Baseball Hall of Fame, when it was first established, they wanted the third party credibility and naturally the promotion of the newspapers.
So sure.
The Baseball Hall of Fame asked the baseball writers to please vote. for the players, and then that therefore they would get third-party credibility of the, you know, the people who are most expert and impartial, the most expert and impartial people available would be the daily newspaper reporters that covered the team, would vote, and then naturally would promote the, you know, museum. And so over the years, the rules have changed and tweaked here and there, but as of now, if you are an active member of the Baseball Writers Association of America for 10 consecutive years, you get a vote for the Hall of Fame, and you retain that vote for life, even if you retire or you leave the, you no longer are an active baseball writer. And to be an active baseball, a BBWAA cardholder, I don't remember the exact criteria, but it's somewhere around you have to cover about 120 games a year out of 162. So beat writers naturally easily do this.
Sure.
Baseball columnists do this also. So, you know, it was great. It was a really cool thing to have at the beginning, and it still is great. It's a great honor and a great privilege to be able to do this. I take it very seriously. There's only about 550 people that cast votes last year, and so, you know, this. So I have a vote, and my first year covering baseball was disillusioning in that the players and the owners were willing to cancel the World Series in a dispute over money, and that was a reality check for me. That was a sobering moment. Killed a lot of the romance that I had for baseball. That I, you know, that we fans have. You think of, you know, your baseball is an idealistic thing, and you have this childlike love for it, and you apply a lot of romance to the game, and to see like these guys just fighting so bitterly and in such a vulgar way over money to the point that they were willing to cancel the World Series was kind of if that doesn't let you know, like, these guys don't have the touchy-feely, you know, emotions for the game that the fans do, you know. So, and it's healthy. It's healthy to see reality and to be, you know, I guess, I don't know if being disillusioned is healthy, but it's not healthy to be naive and foolish in your views, and you know, at some point you learn Santa Claus doesn't exist, and at some point you learn the real priorities of many of the players and the owners in professional baseball, and that same kind of fight, that's, you know, the problem that was at the root of that fight is what led to the epidemic of steroid usage that guys went for what they knew was an unfair edge to try to have better statistics so they could make more money. And lots of people were complicit, but the people that were most guilty were the users. You can't, you know, it's like to say that sports writers didn't write enough about this, guilty as charged, but the owners didn't, okay, yeah. But, I mean, the guy who uses the drug is ultimately the guilty party. It's like a pitcher blaming a catcher for calling the wrong pitch. Like, don't throw the pitch if you don't want to throw the pitch. So, you know, just because lots of people were around when this was happening doesn't make them equally culpable. And these guys knowingly cheated, and it started out a trickle, and then it got, and then it became a landslide. Became a tidal wave, if we're keeping the, you know, water analogy,
right.
And they, you know, they didn't deal with it for far too long, and the game was, the record, the game was changed, and the record book was changed forever, illegitimately, and so, you know, how is there not going to be some accounting for that?
Yeah.
How is there some accounting for that? And so, that's my question, and I understand why people vote for the guys, you know, that either were linked to steroids or not from the era, but I understand. There's lots of different reasons, and I'm not going to get into that or pointing fingers, but, you know, this isn't, the Hall of Fame is an honor. It's not an entitlement. The statistics have not been clawed back. The salaries have not been clawed back. The endorsements have not been clawed back. But And so people have asked me, by not voting for these guys, why are you punishing them? I'm not punishing anybody. I'm just not extending the greatest honor there is in baseball to guys who I believe acted dishonorably. And the six criteria for Hall of Fame election are playing ability, playing record, character, integrity, sportsmanship, and contributions to the teams on which you played. Three of the six have to deal with character, integrity, sportsmanship. So, you know, how do you say somebody earns the ultimate honor in those areas when they either knowingly took a drug that they knew was cheating, because every baseball player who ever took steroids thought he was cheating. They didn't think they were cheating when they took greenies. They didn't think they were cheating if they smoked pot or, you know, snorted cocaine. They thought they were cheating when they took steroids. They knew it. They knew it was wrong. They denied it forever. They knew it was cheating. They thought it was cheating. And therefore, that goes to the heart of integrity within the game. And I don't believe there were very many players who sustained greatness for a long time worthy of Hall of Fame consideration who didn't at least try steroids. But rather than play the game of trying to figure out who did, who didn't, and, well, if he was in the Mitchell Report, he wasn't, et cetera, it was so widespread, it was so well-known, and so many guys just didn't say anything. They turned a blind eye, and they had so many different opportunities to step forward and say, we need to do something about this. And Rick Helling had the guts. Rick Helling, not exactly a big superstar, had the guts to stand up in a union meeting late 90s. This is Tom Verducci's reporting, excellent reporting in the book The Yankee Years that he wrote with Joe Torre. And Rick Helling stood up and said, we need to do this. We need to address this. This is a problem. We have to do something with this. And the rest of the guys were silent. All they had to say was, he's right. We should do this. And, you know, as we look back, there's people that apologize for the players who didn't do anything as if there was some great pressure on them. Would have been great, some great stigma. It's ridiculous. I mean, if Rick Helling could do it, if Rick Helling could stand up and say that, then these other guys could have and should have. And so that's why I'm not willing to cast a vote in honor of their integrity, sportsmanship, and character.
Well, and that leads to, and you've covered so many topics, but let me, if I could stop you for a half a second, and some in the audience are probably not aware that you voted last year for Alan Trammell, Tim Raines, Jack Morris, and Hideo Nomo. You mentioned Nomo earlier. I think it's fair to say that you caught a lot of flack, is probably fair. Just kind of what was the response like, and how did you deal with it, first and foremost?
Yeah, I mean, it was fine. It was fun. No problem. It was fun. I mean, I voted for Nomo. He was the one exception I made playing in the steroid era. I admitted, possibly naive belief that he never used, but I gave him points for the trailblazing, opening the door, changing baseball forever by opening the door to Japanese players. Yeah, there was a lot of criticism. It was all good-natured. I did a couple radio interviews, and it was a spirited debate, but civilized and fun, no problem. And there were a few crazy people who, like, you know, called me at my office and yelled at me, and like random fans. But I mean, you know, that's what makes America great. So no problem at all. No problem at all. I don't mind. I mean, if you're in the wrong business. I mean, I'm not in the business anymore, but I would have been in the wrong business if I was going to be upset if people disagreed with me. So, and debate is good. It's healthy. And, look, Pope Francis is inviting debate on far more controversial topics than the Hall of Fame ballots. So no problem. So no problem at all. And I dealt with it by, you know, I don't remember. I was just resigning from my job at Prep, and so I probably was focused more on, like, transferring my 403B to my IRA or something. I wasn't too worried about the thing. We had some fun. My younger brother, who's got a lot of Twitter followers, had a funny line. He's like, he wrote something along his Twitter feed, said, to all those people trashing my brother for his Hall of Fame vote, please show some respect and trash him at his Twitter handle. And he put my Twitter handle on it.
Nice.
But anyway, plus I don't accept Twitter followers. I only have, like, 50 or something like that. I think I just accepted you today. But anyway, yeah, it was fun. No problem. And, You know, what I love about this is that you often hear people say that baseball is dying and, you know, nobody cares and all these other sports are more popular. When have you ever heard a debate about who got into the Football Hall of Fame or the Basketball Hall of Fame? I defy anybody out there to name the last three NFL Hall of Fame classes, like, without looking on the internet. Like, it's impossible. You never hear a controversy about who won the MVP in another sport. So this is just more proof that baseball is really the most popular sport. It really still is the pastime. It's there, maybe in your subconscious, but things like this bring it out, and people care. They get fired up, and I think that's good.
Yeah, I think you took the words out of my mouth. It's neat to see the passion that people have for something as really inconsequential to their life as who's in or not in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, no, it's fun. It makes it fun. It makes it interesting. It keeps it you know, it's proof that it's relevant. And you know, I mean, it'd be kind of sad if everybody voted, if everybody cast an identical ballot and everybody agreed.
Yeah, where's the fun in that?
Where would be the fun in that? I mean, it's like, I mean, human beings are going to have different opinions, so no problem.
So now, fast forward. What does your ballot look like in 2015?
Oh yeah, we skipped that. We kind of assumed the obvious. All right, so I voted for only Tim Raines and Alan Trammell for the reasons that I articulated earlier. That I think nobody. I think it's not scientific. Naturally, you know, I mean, the Nazis started developing steroids in the 30s to make their soldiers more aggressive, and there's a lot of speculation that people were using steroids in professional sports in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But as far as, you know, the most educated guess I have right now, as of today, based on my own experience, based on what I've heard and pieced together and seen, is that it didn't really reach real critical mass in Major League Baseball until 1994. And so I'm kind of roughly saying the steroid era began in 94. And I am also applying, you know, not exactly hard and fast rule, that if you played the bulk of your career in that era, then I'm saying that you are complicit in the crime against baseball, of this mass crime that was committed against baseball that an entire generation of players committed. And it's impossible to extract one or two guys and say, oh, he was innocent. I don't think so. At that point, they're all guilty, at least of complicity, if not of actually using the drug. And I think if the real number came out on how many people actually ever tried steroids at least once, you would be shattered. So you'd be shattered. There's enough anecdotal evidence that would link just about any guy that is up there for Hall of Fame consideration. There are people in the game that can point out statistical, you know, aberrations, like suddenly a guy regaining foot speed or power or arm strength or recovering from an injury in a very, very atypical manner late in his career at a certain age or whatever. And, you know, that becomes a witch hunt, and I'm not on a witch hunt. And so, or he said, she said. I just think this was such a massive problem for so long, neglected by so many. These guys all reap the benefits of increased attendance, increased salaries, increased TV ratings and all that, that they all have to share the burden of, you know, what did they say about Hitler's willing executioners, right? It wasn't just the Nazi soldiers who exterminated the Jews that were guilty. There were regular citizens in Germany that, you know, share responsibility. And so,
and I can respect that take. That makes sense. I think in some ways the Baseball Writers Association and the Hall of Fame hasn't done right by you guys by not giving you either we're going to vote for these guys or we're not going to vote for these guys.
No, that's a fair point, but I don't agree with that. I think that it's there. I think the criteria is there. And the six criteria are clear, and it's up to each voter to interpret. And this is why there's a standard, you know. If you covered baseball for 10 years in a row, then, you know, this rule came about before the Malcolm Gladwell book Outliers. Remember he had the 10,000 hour rule.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so, I mean, I think that's pretty good. You know, what's the argument there's some people that argue, well, you haven't covered baseball in 10 years, you shouldn't have a vote anymore. And, well, you know, Al Trammell retired basically when I started covering baseball. So, like, why would a guy covering today be more qualified to render judgment on Al Trammell than me, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you would have a much better idea of Alan Trammell's career than I would, just by...
I mean, it's just that you can look at statistics, and it's not just done by a statistical analysis. Otherwise, we wouldn't have humans voting. I mean, there's... And the criteria are character, integrity, sportsmanship. That's not measured by statistics. So these are people that, you know, there are organic qualities to the criteria and intangibles. And so you're there, you observed, you judged, you know, and then in your judgment, who is worthy of the highest honor? I mean, so.
Well, then that.
I don't think, as of now, I reserve the right to change my mind. I might change my mind next year. I don't think I will. I don't think I'll change my mind anytime soon, but I might. And as of now, I have not heard a compelling argument, an argument compelling enough to make me believe that anyone in that generation is worthy of the ultimate honor based on the criteria. If they say that if next year the Hall of Fame ballot criteria is only playing ability, playing record, and contributions to the team, well, then I'll change my vote. But the three, you know, character, integrity, and sportsmanship are there. So how do you ignore that?
I think that's a great point. So then let me ask you this. Why do Raines and Trammell get your vote then? Obviously they're terrific players, but in your opinion, what puts them over the top?
Yeah, I mean, Tim Raines was the second greatest leadoff hitter of all time. And I think if he had been playing anywhere but Montreal, he would have been in a long time ago. Just that he was so under the radar in Montreal.
Yeah, I don't think people
overshadowed
understand.
Overshadowed by Ricky Henderson. I think Alan Trammell was a great player on many excellent Tigers teams and great consistency, leadership, et cetera. I think that his numbers... You know, this happened to Dale Murphy, who I voted for also. I think that his numbers were, damaged by the steroid guys because in comparison they look so weak, you know. Suddenly shortstops were hitting 30, 40 homers a year, and then it looked like, well, Alan Trammell sucked. Well, he didn't suck, you know, in his era. I mean, he was a great player, an MVP on a championship team. I mean, so I also think, you know, I think that if you are covering the game for this long and then you see the guy come up on the ballot, it should really jump out at you, Hall of Famer or not. I don't see how there's many, many close calls. Like, it should either be a slam dunk or not.
Yeah, that's always been my opinion. You should look at it and it's just...
There's some that are gray. You're like, hey, yeah, I wonder... Like, I changed. At first, I didn't vote for Burt Blylev, and then I changed. First, I didn't vote for Dale Murphy, and then I changed. Same with Jack Morris. They didn't scream Hall of Famer to me when I first considered. But, like, Jim Rice did. You know, maybe I guess I'm crazy because he didn't come close. Dave Parker, to me, screamed Hall of Famer. And so, to me, you know, I think Tim Raines and Alan Trammell. And maybe the very first time I considered it, they didn't. But when you really, you know, and I've read some of the arguments in support of them, and probably that influenced me also. And there's a reason, you know, they have the guys on the ballot up for 15 years. That's changing now, but they were grandfathered in. And you know, I think the rules are good. It takes you 10 years to get your vote. A guy stays. It takes 5 years for the guy to get on the ballot. He can be on the ballot for 15 years as long as he gets 5% of the vote. Those were the rules for a long time. They've been altered a little bit, but it gives people time to consider. It gives more and more voters who covered the person or didn't cover the person to consider, to compare from one generation to the next. That's another one of the great crimes, which I've alluded to, of the steroid era, that it's made it so difficult to compare numbers across generations. Of course, that was always difficult. Before 1947, blacks unfairly excluded. So you had this great pool of talent that was unfairly excluded. So how meaningful are those accomplishments before 1947? And of course, you know, it wasn't like suddenly 1947, it was totally fair. So it took how many years? Probably 10 years before, at least 10 years before.
Yeah, every bit.
All the really, you know, deserving black players were given jobs in Major League Baseball. And then the mound, you know, the height of the mound changed. The ball has been tinkered with from time to time. But even accounting for those factors, nothing was like what happened with steroids. And steroids was happening at the same time that the strike zone was shrinking, the ballparks were shrinking. We think the ball was juiced probably, you know, 94. And, you know, there's traces of this. There's an article in Sports Illustrated, I think it was written by Tom Berducci, interviewed a lot of people, and I think the title of the article is "Where Have You Gone, Joe DiMaggio?" It was the early 90s, and Bud Selig was quoted in there bemoaning the lack of, like, real heroes in baseball, and that's what baseball needs, like some, like, home run kings and things like that to draw the fans back. And if you read that in light of what we now know, it's like, yeah, the owners definitely were happy this was happening. They, whether or not they knew about steroids, and I'm sure many of them knew, they were happy, you know, because everybody was getting richer. It was, but Selig ran out in the field and gave McGuire and I think even Sosa that medal, you know. What an embarrassment in retrospect.
Yeah, it was a little over the top.
They were so eager to, like, you know, celebrate all this stuff. It was so short-sighted. So, and of course, expansion also, you know, changes
well,
baseball.
And you nailed it too earlier, saying, you know, the strike in 94, they needed to try to get those fans back. So it seemed like they went over the top trying to celebrate Sosa and McGuire and all these guys hitting the home runs, trying to get the fans back in the stands.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's a business. And so, you know, it's a tricky situation. It's too much of a sport to be a business, and it's too much of a business to be just a sport. And I'm of the opinion that it's kind of a public trust, and that owners have, you know, in exchange for the rights that are conferred on them with the antitrust exemption and these other special privileges they get, they have more of a civic duty than many of them. Many owners are great, you know, civic people, but some of them are not. And I think that, you know, leagues have more, professional sports leagues have more responsibility than they're willing to bear as far as, like, goodwill, you know, to society and fans and all that. That, but at the heart of it is, a business enterprise, and so at the end of the day, the decisions will be driven by financial considerations.
So then the next question, and I don't want to pound this drum too hard, and you did say, you know, your mind could change, certainly, and we've talked about this before. What are you going to do when guys like Griffey and Derek Jeter come on the ballot? I mean, you probably covered Jeter. I mean, you probably know him well.
Yeah, I covered Jeter. I mean, at this point, I don't know. I mean, at this point, there would be no, and if they were on the ballot this year, I wouldn't have voted for them. So, I mean, I made the one exception on Nomo last year, and I'm admitting that might have been the screwy exception, but I'm not going to apply a different standard to Ken Griffey than I applied to Pedro Martinez.
And I think that's the only way you can do it. I think that's fair. So then...
That's as of now, right? I mean,
right, sure.
I mean, they might change the voting rules. I might not even have a vote next year, so... you can sell copies of this podcast because it'll be so rare.
Yeah, everybody would be clamoring, that's for sure. So what... Would you do any? Would you make any changes to the voting process?
I would not. No, and you know, I haven't. But it's a good question. I've never thought about it. I mean, the Hall of Fame can decide whatever they want. They're the ones who ask. That's the other thing. Like, you guys shouldn't have a vote. I was like, okay, fine. I mean, the Hall of Fame is the one who requested that we vote. So that was one of the things last year. If it were up to me, you wouldn't have a vote. I think Lou Merlone was saying. It was like, well, I'm glad you're not. I'm glad it's not your decision. And
right.
You know, why would Lou Merlone get a vote? And so that's the other odd argument. Like, do we really want to reduce the number of voters?
Yeah, like, does that make it any better?
Yeah, so I would say, I mean, the Hall of Fame, it's a museum. And they're trying to, you know, it's a museum. It's a business enterprise also. I don't think they're trying to make money like, you know, Google or Microsoft is, but they strategically ask the writers to vote in order for third-party credibility and promotion of the museum and promotion of baseball. So if they decide they want other voters, it's their prerogative. I would think they wouldn't do that anytime soon because I think it would backfire on them. It's also funny because if you look, if you have existing Hall of Famers vote, I mean, they're even tougher than the writers. Existing Hall of Famers are very, very, very tough in their voting. They are like, hey, buddy, you know, you're not a member of our club unless you really clear the bar at this level. I mean, so that would be a funny one. I bet you fewer guys would get the Hall of Fame if the voting were done only by the current members of the Hall of Fame than by the writers. I think the writers are more generous than the Hall of Famers.
But in some ways, that makes sense.
Full timers' voting patterns.
I think that makes sense in some ways. You're more willing to let somebody in a club that you're not necessarily in than the people that are actually in that club.
Yeah, and also the psychology of like the guys who've got that edge. You know, that
right.
Guys be that great had to like believe in themselves so much, and you know, fight and scratching, you know, for everything. And so, but anyway, you know, this is one of the great things about baseball in America, and you know, as long as the debate doesn't get too personal, it's fun. So,
yeah, and it gets me talking to you about baseball.
As long as you don't start dropping F-bombs on me right now, everything will be great.
Yeah, no, I mean, and like you say, it gets you and I in a room talking baseball, so can't be better than that. So, if you would indulge me, just one non-Hall of Fame question today.
Fans watching baseball, that would be better.
Yeah, that's a good call. Particularly with an adult beverage in our hands.
Yeah.
But if you would indulge me, just one non-Hall of Fame question. With your time all the time with Bobby V, can you share your favorite or your best Bobby V story?
You know, I mean, my best Bobby V story that to me illustrates his true character is a very personal story. In November of 2003, he got hired. He was working at ESPN, and a team in Japan hired him to go back to Japan for the So just to refresh everybody's memory, he managed the Texas Rangers from 86 through 92, I believe, or 85 maybe, through 92. Got fired by George Bush, who was the owner, and Tom Schieffer was the team president, the brother of Bob Schieffer, and then future ambassador to Japan, actually. And we actually saw him in Japan later. So then team in Japan hired him, the Chibolote Marines. He managed there for 1 year in 1995, fired. Mets hired him in August of 96 to manage the Mets. Managed the Mets through the 02 season, got fired. I mean, this happens, you know, managers get hired to get fired. And so we became, you know, had a great personal relationship, friendly professional relationship. Loved interviewing him. I learned so much about baseball from him. It was great fun. And he knew how interested I was in Japanese baseball. So October or November, the team in Japan hired him to come bring him back. He left ESPN, and I was talking about it. I was like, oh, man, I'd love to go with you. And he said, oh, why don't you come? You can, you know, he like threw out some kind of like vague job possibility. And I didn't really take it very seriously, but I also thought, you know, I had just been promoted to columnist at my newspaper the year before. I had just moved in with my girlfriend who was about to propose to, and my father was very sick. He had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and at that point it wasn't really clear, you know, what was going to happen with him. And so, you know, just timing in my life certainly wasn't good. It wasn't a clear offer or anything. That's November of 2003. Then October 28, 2004, my dad dies. Funeral's November 1st. My fiance and I break things off on November 6th. My sports editor was not very, very understanding or patient or supportive during these ordeals.
Ooh.
And I called Bobby on November 8th and said, you know, that offer last year, whatever fake offer you gave me last year, please give me a real offer this time. Just get me out of here. And 10 days later, on November 18th, 10 days later, I was on a business class plane ticket to Japan for the interview. But since it was an $8,300 plane ticket, I had a feeling I was going to get the job. And so, yeah, they hired me. And so at my lowest point, at my absolute lowest point, I reached out to him and asked him for help. And it wasn't pure charity. He thought I could do the job, and I did do a good job for him there. And it was a great time. But Bobby comes through for people. His first instinct is to help, no matter who it is who asks him to help. His first instinct is always to figure out how he might be able to help. And he's got a huge heart and a great guy. He's nobody's perfect, and but he's got a genius IQ. He's applied it to baseball. He is a baseball genius without a doubt. And, it's unfortunate that things went so poorly in Boston. There were a lot of issues there, a lot of issues. We could go on forever talking about that. But I think it's a shame that he's not managing in the major leagues right now, because I think he's got, without a doubt, if not the greatest, certainly one of the handful of greatest minds in baseball. And probably the greatest mind in baseball. And that's Bobby V. And he's just a funny guy and smart and never backs down from a challenge, never says no to a request for help, unless he just can't help. And but he always tries to figure out how he can. And just like an incredible, hard charger and great person. Every time my mom emails him, he replies within like 5 minutes.
So, that's pretty amazing.
He threw birthday parties for her in Japan when she was visiting, and he's just a great guy. And it's a shame that more people don't recognize that. I'd really hoped that the Nationals were going to hire him one of these times, and he would have electrified the fan base in D.C. He would like totally own Washington D.C. as far as the head coaching figure in the area. I mean, he'd be on every talk show, and fans in D.C. would love him so much if they could see that up close. And Mike Rizzo is an excellent GM, and I'm not going to second guess any of his moves. It would have been fun to see that happen. So, that's my take on that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, baseball fans know him as kind of the lighthearted, funny guy. The mustache in the dugout. But it's nice to hear a little bit more of a personal side and what a good guy he is. So,
oh yeah,
that's pretty cool. So, Larry, thank you. I appreciate you giving me so much time. I hope this is the first Hall of Fame interview you've given this year. So,
I believe this will be the first and last.
Ooh, okay.
I'm at this point, I'm only voting for two players, and I'm only doing one radio show.
I'll call this an exclusive.
But I reserve the right to change my mind.
I'll call this an exclusive.
There's a reason for that. You're the only one that's requested to interview me so far.
He didn't.
I may have to amend my policy if somebody calls me and asks me. I don't expect that. I think the Nomo vote was what got everyone's attention last year.
Yeah, so. It blew up a little bit, but I had a great time talking to you, and I appreciate how much you respect the process. And I think that's probably the coolest thing, is how much I just know you on a personal level of how serious you take this vote. And I think, if nothing else, I hope that came through from our chat today. So,
you got it, buddy. You're a great American. You are a great American. I wish you all the best of luck in 2015. It would be great. I hope there's a Nationals-Orioles World Series. That'd be awesome.
That would be great. Next time you're in town, let me buy you a beer.
Okay. Thanks, Ryan. Talk to you later.
Thank you so much, Larry. I appreciate it. And that was my chat with Hall of Fame voter Larry Rocca. I want to thank him again for joining me and giving the Nats GM show, I should say, an exclusive interview this year. He's definitely a Hall of Fame voter, cares about baseball greatly, and his passion, I hope, came through just in our talk today. So before we conclude episode 21, can't believe we're on episode 21, I want to thank my producer, the man-child, Josh Owens, for working so hard to turn this podcast around. I know so many people are going to want to listen to this ahead of the Hall of Fame voting, so I appreciate him getting this done. Thank you, buddy. Additionally, I want to remind everyone, the Nats GM Show is now available through iTunes. So please rate and review the podcast, as this helps us attract more listeners and gains a better following for the show. So please do that. Finally, we are still seeking a principal sponsor for the show, so if you are interested, please visit natsgm.com for details. That's it for this week. Bye for now.